Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game. I'm Kevin Day here in O South London. And over there in dear old Sussex-by-the-Sea is football finance expert at Liverpool University, Kieran Maguire. Kieran, have we ever discussed what a dreary song that is, Sussex-by-the-Sea?
It's a marching song from the First World War. It's a regiment song, so it does have a lot of historical impact as far as the club's relations with the local armed forces are concerned.
Oh dear, what a depressing thought that was the last thing some young man heard on his way to the Somme. It's a busy show, Kieran. It's a very busy show. So let's crack on. Later in the episode, we'll hear from Damien Collins, the MP for Folkestone and Hythe, and formerly the chair of the Digital Culture, Media and Sport Parliamentary Committee. Kieran spoke to him about financial governance. I was kept away, possibly because I have the hump with anything to do with the Digital Culture, Media and Sport Parliamentary Committee. But I'm sure it was fascinating, Kieran, wasn't it?
It was. It was very interesting stuff, and we'll have a listen later.
Yes, you will. A busy week of football stories, so let's dive in. Derby County fans can sleep well again.
Yes, it's a superb result as far as Derby County were concerned. They were up on two effective charges. One was to do with the value of Pride Park in terms of a sale to another company owned by the club owner, Mel Morris. It was sold for just over £80 million, and the EFL felt that that wasn't a market value. But the independent committee came down in favour of Derby, so therefore there was no issues with regards to that. And the second charge was due to your favourite topic, amortisation.
Yes, go on. Don't let me explain it, Kieran. I know already.
Well, I mean, the way that amortisation works for every other club apart from Derby is if you were to sign a player for £10 million on a five-year contract, you take 10, divide it by five, and you charge £2 million a year for the player in each year of the contract. Now, what Derby have done, and this is perfectly legal, is they've said we're going to charge, say, we still buy that player for 10 million quid, but we'll only charge £500,000 in year one, £500,000 in year two, year three and year four, and in the final year of his contract, when we know that player values tend to fall quite quickly in the final year of the contract because then they can walk away on a Bosman, we'll charge £8 million. And this has the impact of sort of decelerating costs and increasing your profits. So it's a very clever piece of work, and nobody else has thought of it. And looking at the EFL rules, there's no definitive way how you amortise. So you've got to sort of doff your cap to the accountants at Derby.
Well, Kieran, if you're doffing your cap to accountants, they must be good accountants. For Derby County fans, full reassurance. Is this the end of it? Can somebody appeal?
Well, the EFL has 14 days in which to appeal. Certainly my gut reaction, my understanding was, perhaps the EFL were a bit underprepared and overconfident. And I've been out on a Saturday night underprepared and overconfident, and that tends to result in me coming home alone. So I think they're probably feeling how I used to feel in my youth.
Yeah, overprepared and underconfident is just as bad, isn't it? The EFL have obviously been busy because they've reached a deal with Sky Sports that would enable clubs in all three divisions to stream every match next season live. Is that good news financially?
Well, I think it's good news for fans, and you got to give some credit to the EFL here because they are keen for fans to be able to see as many matches as possible. The EFL have a present deal with Sky, which allows Sky to show 130 matches live. So if you've got a Sky subscription, you'll still see those matches. But if you want to watch any other matches, what Sky are going to do sort of in conjunction with the EFL is that it's going to cost you a tenner to watch each match, and you can watch it through a streaming service. The EFL already have one called iFollow. They're going to review this over the season, sort of on a month-by-month basis, because you know clearly we anticipate returning with no crowds and then a gradual introduction of crowds to stadia. But if you are a diehard fan and you're desperate to see your club play for every single match, then this is some consolation.
I hope some that the EFL is recording this pod, Kieran, because they'll all be gathered around going, yes, he did say give the EFL some credit. Yeah, they'll all be high-fiving. They'll be delighted with that news, Kieran. But on a similar note, there will be an extra 20 Premier League games shown live on TV next season. But unlike the end of last season, there won't be blanket coverage of matches at the start of this one, despite it kicking off behind closed doors.
Yes, and this one does seem a little bit strange. So what the Premier League have done is with their senior broadcasters, and by that I mean Sky, BT Sport and Amazon, they've given them an extra 20 games, which takes us up to 220 in total, that will now be shown live via broadcast. But that at the same time means that 160 matches are effectively going to take place behind closed doors, you know, unless we do have some form of return to where fans can't see their team. And, you know, you and I, we both are pretty diehard fans. We've got 100 years of watching our teams between us. Mm. And I think this sort of discriminates against some clubs because looking at the number of matches that get screened historically, if you're a fan of Burnley and Watford and clubs of that ilk, you don't tend to be shown very often on live TV. So it's going to mean that you're not going to see your team play very often, whereas to a certain extent, Liverpool, Chelsea, Manchester United, Manchester City and so on, because they are the darlings of the broadcasters, and that's understandable, they yeah. deliver in terms of a viewing audience, the fans of those clubs aren't going to miss out too often.
Yeah, let's be fair, Kieran, from the broadcaster's point of view, they also tend to deliver in terms of performance and goals as well, because to be quite honest, if we start the season the way we ended it, I don't want to see us on telly, to be honest, and I don't think anybody else would tune in either. Harry Maguire has been found guilty of aggravated assault, resisting arrest and attempted bribery, hence his nickname in your branch of the Maguire family, the lightweight. Now, I'm sure they're very proud of him, Kieran, but really, they'll be tutting, really. This is entry-level criminality for a Maguire, isn't it? Will this impact Harry Maguire or Man United financially?
I don't think Manchester United will be hurt overall. They do have clearly sponsor arrangements, but there's plenty of other players that if a sponsor says, well, we'd rather Harry Maguire wasn't shown advertising our noodles or our tractor tyres, then I'm sure the club will be quite flexible on this. I think from a financial perspective, Harry Maguire could potentially be hit here because what he will have is that if he is any sort of personal sponsor arrangements, there'll be what we have known as a bad faith clause. And if you remember what happened with Lance Armstrong when he got into a bit of bother in relation to the Tour de France a few years ago, it meant that some of the sponsors started demanding money back or refused to pay him. I wouldn't worry too much if I was Harry. You know, he's on a £10 million a year contract by all accounts, so he's not going to suffer in terms of his contract with his main employer, but it could have an impact upon some of his sundry arrangements in terms of intellectual property rights and things of that nature.
I quite like the idea of Harry Maguire sponsoring or advertising tractor tyres because he's one of the few players who couldn't get a tractor tyre over his head. But I'm guessing, though, that a sponsor if a sponsor was to pull out and say they were unhappy with this situation, would that sort of not jeopardise his appeal? Because, I mean, he's insisting that he's not guilty and he is going to appeal. So I guess a sponsor would rather wait until that was heard. Or does this sort of cast a shadow over, you know, a particular family-friendly or child-friendly sponsorship deal, for example?
Well, I think Manchester United are on very good relations with the vast majority of their sponsors, and therefore they will be flexible. What we tend to see in issues of this nature is that the sponsors, as you inferred, they have a hiatus. They tend to adopt a wait and see approach, and it could be if Harry Maguire is found innocent in respect of his appeal, then it's all systems go as before.
Now, Lionel Messi has told Barcelona, and this is the bit I like, he told them by fax, which you'd imagine he could afford something more up to date, wouldn't he? But he's told them by fax that he wants to leave. How much would he cost and who could afford him? And could you think Palace and Brighton do a timeshare?
Well, the cost of Lionel Messi is somewhere between 0 and 700 million euros, and clearly that covers quite a big range.
Yeah, 700 million euros, Kieran, is what it covers.
700 million, very good.
Yeah, yes. Thank you. I'm learning. It's only taking me a year, but I'm learning. All numbers. I'm doing numbers now. Look.
So Barcelona have a buyout clause in Lionel Messi's contract, which says that if a club wants to sign him whilst he is their player, then it's going to cost that club potentially 700 million euros. However, it also appears that Lionel Messi, he has a clause in his contract which allowed him to walk away from the club by mid-June for nothing. Now, clearly, we're not in mid-June. We're now towards the end of August. But what his side are arguing is that as a result of the pandemic, the season was effectively stretched. And his original contract gave him sort of 2 weeks from the end of the season in which to make this decision. It's now within 2 weeks of the end of the 2019-20 season, as we've just created. So therefore, he's entitled to do the same. I spy opportunities for silver-tongued friends of ours to get involved in this one, because clearly, if he is able to walk away for nothing, then potentially the number of suitors for his talents, and I've seen Lionel Messi play live, and frankly, if you get an opportunity to see this one at least once in your life, go for it, folks. It was an incredible experience. Then there's likely to be interest in the Premier League, in League One, in France from PSG, but also from Italy. And the reason for that is that the Italian government introduced sort of an extension of what we sometimes refer to in the tax world as the Beckham Law. And under Italian tax rules, if you are a footballer and you sign a 2-year contract minimum, the first 50% of your income would be untaxed. Now, if you're Lionel Messi, whose salary at Barcelona was 100 million euros, to get half of that taxed for nothing would be very attractive.
Yeah, am I allowed to say to do that legally as well would be very attractive?
It's very legal. It's very legal indeed, yes.
Yes, but he has flirted with things that perhaps are on the fringe of. Let's leave that there. I mean, under normal circumstances, a player of his age, Kieran, wouldn't attract that much interest. But I'm guessing, I mean, if he were to come to Man City, for example, the money they would make in merchandising would be huge. I mean, every single Man City fan is going to want a Man City shirt with Messi on the back of it, aren't they?
That they would do. I'm always a little bit cautious when it comes to sales of merchandise, because ultimately, if you're going to buy a shirt with Messi on, the chances are you would have been buying a shirt with Sterling or Aguero on. So all you're doing is you're switching numbers and names rather than buying an additional shirt. Although what it could do is that from City's perspective, if he signs a 2 or 3 year contract, when it comes to negotiating an international tour before the start of next season, and I'm assuming here that we've made progress in terms of COVID, which is perhaps a bit optimistic of me, City would then, to a certain extent, be able to name their price. Normally, what happens when you go on pre-season tours, you effectively agree a price with a promoter. If you've got Lionel Messi in your squad, I think you can add a couple of million to the asking price.
Yes, I left a little pause there, Kieran, for you to do a Messi shirt joke, but you're obviously in a disappointingly mature mood today. So, Barcelona, I'm going to say Lionel Messi's ex-team now, they were battered 8-2 by Bayern in the Champions League, and now it turns out that Bayern may be about to batter them in the wallet as well.
Yes, this is all to do with Philippe Coutinho. Coutinho, as we're all aware, he was signed by Barcelona from Liverpool on a contract. And you know, as we're becoming increasingly familiar, contracts normally have an agreed fee plus a series of top-ups. Now, it could be that included in that top-up would be additional money that Barcelona have to pay to Liverpool if Philippe Coutinho wins the Champions League whilst a Barcelona player. Well, he is a Barcelona player. Mm. He came on in the semi-final and scored twice against Barcelona for that incredible 8-2 match. And now that Bayern have won the Champions League, it could be another 5 million euros or 5 million sterling. We're not quite sure which one, which might have to go from Barcelona to Liverpool, which I think really would rub the noses in it. Now, depending upon which paper you read, it could be that the money is only due if Barcelona win the Champions League as opposed to Coutinho. But again, silver-tongued opportunities here. It's a case of going through the small print and identifying exactly what's happened.
Yeah, I mean, that game was astonishing. I mean, if you were a Barca fan, you'd be sitting there thinking, well, it can only get worse if Coutinho comes on and says, oh, dear. Still in Europe, UEFA, and I don't know whether this is a surprise or not, Kieran, that UEFA have decided not to appeal against Man City's Court of Arbitration for Sport verdict.
I don't think UEFA had very much chance of making progress on this. They might have been hoping that, given that the Manchester City verdict wasn't unanimous, it was two people in favour of the club and one person in favour of UEFA, that they might have been able to convene another panel and perhaps get things to go in their favour. But it looks as if UEFA have taken the view that, given that we're so close to the start of the 2020-21 season, they wouldn't be able to bring this rule in for this season in terms of banning Manchester City. And we are seeing sort of olive branches being offered in both directions by both the club and UEFA. There's a lot of bridges which were burned in relation to this decision, because you might recall that the 8 or 9 Premier League clubs did write to UEFA in support of the original ban, which clearly has caused a disturbance in the relationship between City and many of its peer group. We've seen the head of La Liga call into question the integrity of CAS, which seems a rather harsh thing to do. Mm. And Bayern Munich have been sniping away, trying to take some sort of moral high ground as the arbiters of what's good taste in terms of maintaining financial fair play rules.
Nice little bit of German pronunciation there with arbiters. Very good. Will City know who those 9 clubs were that in the Premier League that got the hump then?
Yes, because if you go through the small print of the CAS ruling, it did name them. So it will come as no great surprise that Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, Spurs were all involved there, because potentially you knock City out of the Champions League places for 2 years. You can see the benefits. It was a bit more surprising to see Newcastle mentioned in those. I don't know what Mike Ashley was expecting in terms of resurgence under Steve Bruce in terms of Newcastle challenging for the European places. But this could be a sort of a subtle masterstroke by Mike. Perhaps he, as part of the potential deal to sell Newcastle to PIF, thought, well, they might be willing to put in a few zillions into the club, and therefore this is an opportunity for him to get a higher price for Newcastle. So there's always, with these events, there's more to it than meets the eye.
Yeah, so it's good news for Man City, and it seems like the owners are celebrating by trying to buy another club. Which club is it and why?
Well, this is a club in France. It is called Estac Troyes, and Estac stands for Espérance Sportive Troyes Aubé Champagne, which takes me up to my grade C O-level in French in 1978. So this is a club who've sort of, they're a bit of a yo-yo club between League One and League Two in France. They were in League One as recently as 2018. They finished fourth in League Two in 2019. And my one concern here would be that if they did manage to get back into League One and then qualified for European place, that could cause issues if ever they were drawn in a group against Manchester City. So that could have been a bit of a strange one, and UEFA might have had to get involved there as well.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear you're not that good at French, Kieran, but why have they chosen this particular club?
Well, City, I think they are looking for clubs in Europe now to use as development vehicles. So they've got one in Belgium, they've got one in Spain, they've now got one in France. I think they see that because there are going to be complications when the new set of rules arise with regard to transferring players who historically were able to use freedom of movement, that they might be able to use this Estac Troyes club as sort of a holding area until players get sufficient international caps that they'd qualify for a move to the Premier League.
So, I mean, if you're sitting there in France, not in a bar, obviously, because we saw what the riot police did to French people watching football in a bar the other night, but if you're an Estac Troyes fan sitting there in France, is this only good news for your club?
I think it really is, because the club will get the benefit of some of the expertise of City in terms of data analysis, player recruitment, training, things of that nature. It could be that City might play a pre-season friendly there, especially if they're not able to go outside of Europe as a result of the pandemic. Mm. So that will be good for increasing the profile of the local club. And having a connection with a club which is increasing its global footprint, such as City, can be beneficial when you're trying to negotiate sponsor arrangements and things of that nature.
And from France to Spain, and Malaga have told their squad they plan to begin a collective dismissal procedure.
Yeah, I think Malaga are up a creek, and it's not a good one.
It really is, Kieran, to be honest. We very rarely talk of the good creeks. Oh, I'm at that good creek again. I haven't got a paddle. Doesn't matter. It's a good creek. It's fine.
So CF Malaga, they're in the second division of the Spanish league. And they were facing administration by the looks of it. They had around about a 15 million euro funding gap. They had players on quite high wages. So what they've said is that they went to the players originally, said, will you take pay cuts? The players said no. So they've effectively ripped up 11 contracts for those players. So therefore, Malaga won't be able to receive a fee for those players. They've only now got five players on the books, but the alternative was to go into administration. And under Spanish football rules, that would have instigated an automatic relegation, and they would have gone into one of the Spanish regional leagues. They've also got some financial problems with their owners. And normally, when we see clubs have Middle Eastern owners, we tend to think of the money flowing one way, which is from the owner to the club. But in respect of Malaga, it turns out that their owner, Sheikh Abdullah Al Thani, he apparently owes the club 7.3 million euros. Oh. And therefore, that's put the club into an even bigger pickle as far as its monetary situation is concerned.
So this is not all necessarily COVID related. This is also this is something that would have been bubbling under anyway, has it?
Yes, I mean they have been they've been having problems for a couple of years now, and as we've said on many an occasion, clubs are in a very poor position to cope with any form of financial shock. You add something of the magnitude of COVID, and it does really sort of shake the tree out in terms of those clubs that were previously looking precarious.
That's a harsh punishment, isn't it? Automatic relegation, but I can't recall in recent years any Spanish or teams going into administration. I mean, certainly not at the level that we are aware of.
No, that is the case. I mean, Spanish clubs In the main, because they know who's going to win La Liga each year, it means that most of them tend to sort of live within their means. It's not like what the situation we see here in England, especially in the Championship, where at the start of the season, realistically, you're looking at three clubs from 13 or 14 who could have a good season. And that tends to encourage a bit of an arms race in terms of spending. And the 10 clubs that don't go up then tend to be struggling financially.
So I wasn't planning to get involved in this discussion, but so teams in the league below the top league in Spain, they don't tend then to spend the money that our Championship teams would do to try and get in the top league, presumably, do they?
No, because unlike the Premier League versus the Championship, the gap in the Spanish TV deal isn't as big between the bottom of La Liga and the top of La Liga 2.
Okay. Well, I know a Palace fan who moved from Maidstone to Malaga. Why did I say Malaga? Yeah, let's call it Malaga. That's the South London pronunciation. Now, he moved from Maidstone to Malaga and is now a Malaga and Palace fan as well. So he'll be listening to this with some dismay, as will some Bournemouth fans as well, because Bournemouth have made 10 members of staff redundant, which, again, I presume is because of relegation rather than COVID, isn't it?
Yes, I suspect there's an element of both involved. I mean, Bournemouth will be looking at a substantial reduction in income. And if you take a look at their figures for last year, 88% of their money came through TV. So with they'll be relying on parachute payments this year. Those parachute payments will fall as a result of the reduction in the value of the TV deals that we have here in England. So that's going to hit the club. Their sponsorship arrangements, they'll be hit as well. So clearly they've done their sums. I've got to be honest, compared to some of the other clubs I've been looking at that have been relegated, I think Bournemouth have been relatively restrained. When Sunderland were relegated from the Premier League through into League One in two seasons, that meant that 220 people lost their jobs. We know that jobs in Sunderland are at a premium, so that was a bad hit. And it was even worse for Aston Villa. The first year they were down in the Championship following relegation in 2016, they shed 550 jobs. So relegation, we've said this on more than one occasion, the fans tend to focus on themselves and, we're not going to be seeing such good football. But my concerns are always for those people who are working in the back office, who are doing the unsung jobs, and they tend to be loyal fans as well themselves, and they get that double hit.
Well, of course, as we've often said on the pod as well, it spreads further than that, because you make 550 people redundant, and that's 550 people who can no longer afford to eat out in local restaurants and cafes, who can no longer afford to buy stuff from local shops. So it affects the whole community. Now, Charlton boss Lee Bowyer, and a lot of people listening to this pod will have seen Lee Bowyer play. He never gave the impression of being a philosopher or a poet or an eloquent young man, but as a manager, I think he's leading his club through beleaguered circumstances with great dignity. But he said this week, in a world-weary sort of way, that there are non-league players who are on more money than they can offer because of their current transfer embargo. Would that be right?
I think historically, certainly when clubs such as Salford City were in the National League, Salford were very generous payers, is my understanding. And I think there are one or two owners of National League clubs who, over the last couple of seasons, have signed players, the likes of Paul Konchesky. He was on incredible money. I think it was at Braintree.
Yeah.
So I think that's what Lee Bowyer was referring to. It looks as if Charlton are under what we refer to as a soft embargo, which is effectively one player in on the basis of one player going out. And under some of the EFL rules, that there appears to be a maximum amount that Charlton can pay. Now, clearly, they're going into League One, where there is a wage cap anyway. Yeah. But if the South London press is correct in respect of this, it looks like Charlton are being limited to £1,300 a week in League Two, which is substantially lower than you'd expect under the League One cap. So Charlton is a bit of a mess at present. And we've also got an issue that one of the prospective owners, a guy called Paul Elliott, who we've described before as a businessman, failed the owners and directors test when trying to buy East Street Investments. We now have a new potential owner, a Danish guy called Thomas Sandgaard, who's been very successful in the US. He's now trying to buy the club. But Paul Elliott has now got an injunction trying to prevent Sandgaard from owning the club. And it then all gets very messy because we're not quite sure what you're buying, because the previous owner, and Charlton, let's face it, have been through an awful lot of owners in the last 12 months. Well, one of their previous owners, Roland de Chachelet, he still owns the Valley. He still owns the training facilities, and he's charging Charlton $200,000 a year rent. But if they're still renting it in 2025, they've then got to go and pay him 50 million quid, which might make one or two people blink and decide not to go ahead with the purchase.
Yeah, I panicked slightly halfway through that because I was worried that you might try and describe the difference between a soft and a hard embargo, which could only be a bad thing. But I was going to ask you about potential new owners as well, though, because the Evening Standard, which is the London newspaper, says that the Danish guy, the prospective new buyer, genuinely doesn't know who to negotiate with.
Well, that's right. I mean, ultimately, he is buying the shares of a company called East Street Investments, which appears to be the owner of Charlton Football Club, Charlton Athletic Football Club Limited. But in terms of this injunction, given that the owners of East Street Investment, given that they've fallen out and they were sending rude letters and solicitors' advice to each other, it must be a real challenge to try to work out who is involved on the selling side here.
Can you see any way out of this for Charlton? I mean, we from the start of this pod, Charlton have been regular guests, unfortunately. And they got rid of, or it seemed they got rid of Chatelet, who was a major, major issue, only for them. I mean, they've gone from a massive frying pan to an even bigger fire. And it's almost impossible to unravel how this is going to end for them, isn't it?
It's going to take some time. I suspect it's going to be expensive in terms of unraveling the relationships and coming to an agreement which is acceptable to de Chachelet, because to a certain extent that he does hold the cards in that he's the legal owner of the Valley and the training ground. The EFL, they weren't happy with the people at ESI, so that's why Charlton had a transfer embargo in January. Mm. They clearly have issues with regards to Paul Elliott. So again, we've got to give them some credit here. They are trying to invoke a set of rules which, in my view, are almost impossible to apply unless you've got some form of government backing for them. And it's going to end up either in a lawsuit or a battle between lawyers, sending each other increasingly snotty letters or faxes.
Speaking of lawsuits, and we did predict this 2 weeks ago when we talked about the salary cap in the EFL, Portsmouth are taking legal advice over whether that salary cap is enforceable.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think, and this is one of the issues that was raised when I had the chat with Damien Collins, that if you have what we refer to as a flat cap, where in League One, you're limited to every club can only pay £2.5 million in player wages. Now, that's if you're Sunderland with average gates of 27,000 to 30,000, Portsmouth with average gates of 20,000, or if you're some of the smaller clubs at the other end of the division who are getting 2,000 to 2,500, that sort of frustrates the owners of Portsmouth. They say that if they apply this cap, they'll only be paying out 30% of their income in wages. The average in League One last season was 81%. So Whilst it's good for Portsmouth's finances, you know, their aim of the owners, and they're owned by a guy called Michael Eisner, who used to be the chief executive of the Disney Corporation. He wants to get them into the Championship and ultimately to the Premier League. And if they've got lots of money coming in through gate receipts, and again, we've got to look at a post-COVID world here, they would have an advantage. But it also gives those clubs that are promoted from League One into the Championship, it gives them a huge headache because their players are on an average of $2,000 a week walking into a division where the average is 16. You know, is this going to create this Premier League Two, and we're going to have this sort of yo-yo effect between the bottom of the Championship and the top of League One?
Yeah, one more story then before our big interview. And I wouldn't say Barnsley are regulars, but they're special guests from now on. They've got a walk-on role every 3 or 4 weeks. And their board is divided, Kieran, over who's owed what following the sale of the club 3 years ago. I mean, 3 years is a long time to still be divided, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very strange one, this. Barnsley Football Club is owned by a company called BFC Investments in Hong Kong. Now, they bought the club for 8 million quid, but they bought the club, but once again, they didn't buy the stadium. And we've just seen what's happened with Charlton again and again. A football club should be attached to its stadium, as far as I'm concerned. And when you start to sell bits and pieces, it ends up in tears. Now, it turns out that the new owners had an option to buy Oakwell in January. They had an option to buy half of it from the old owners. But as well as they having an option, somebody else had an option to buy it as well. And it looks as if the previous owners haven't sold that 50% of Oakwell to BFC Investments. So that's one issue. And the new owners are saying, well, if we knew that they're going to try to flog Oakwell to somebody else, we wouldn't have invested ourselves. Subsequently, it turns out that according to the previous owners, who are the Crine or the Klein family, I can't read my writing here, that BFC Investments still haven't paid £2.75 million that was due as part of the deal to buy Barnsley Football Club. So they are effectively countersuing. Only winners here. Who do you think they're going to be?
Yes, of course. Any combination of the words lawyers, tongue and silver, I guess. Do you know what I don't understand, Kieran? And we have discussed this before, and it's an indication of how much I don't understand it. We keep having to say it. If it so often ends up in tears that you buy a club and not the stadium, why does new buyers' research not show that as a potential problem?
Well, I suspect part of the reason, if you take a look at the Charlton scenario, East Street Investments bought Charlton Athletic Football Club for £1. They didn't buy. If they were having to buy the Valley immediately and the training ground, they'd have had to find another 50 million quid. So a lot of the time, and I'm not making any accusations here, it could be you buy a club for £1. Your view is run it for a few months or a year and then flip it and sell it to somebody else for 5 million quid. And you've just made for yourself 5 million quid profit. And the ground, the stadium, becomes somebody else's problem.
Okay, Damien Collins fans, here's the moment you've all been waiting for. Kieran, how did your chat with the former chair of the Digital, Cultural, Media and Sport Parliamentary Committee come about?
I listened in to Damien when he was heading the select committee into the case of Bury Football Club. And on today, when this pod is going out, it's the 27th of August. That's exactly 1 year to the day from when Bury were expelled from the EFL by other club owners. And I heard Damien Collins and some of his colleagues grill people from the EFL, people from the Football Association, and I've got to say I was impressed. You know, and this is a non-partisan issue. I was impressed by the knowledge and the fact that all of the MPs didn't give these football executives an easy ride. So he does follow me on Twitter, which, you know, is a dangerous thing for anybody to do. as we all know. But you know, he has said that he's interested still in club finance and some of the issues. So I approached him with a review to looking at some of the issues. He brought out a 6-point plan in May for trying to address governance issues in relation to football. He's also been supportive of the Football Supporters Association. They've just brought out a Sustain the Game campaign. So I thought we'd get in touch with him.
Yes, and we'll be talking to the FSA about the Sustain the Game campaign as well in a couple of weeks' time. In the meantime, here's what Damien Collins had to say to Kieran.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Damien, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's exactly 1 year to the day since Bury were expelled from the EFL. So we are delighted to have you on, because I did listen with a lot of interest to the DCMS interrogation or discussion with the football authorities. How would you sum up the state of football governance and finances at present?
Well, I think Bury went bust and was kicked out of the league because of failings at the club, of course, but also because of failings in governance at the Football League itself. If the Football League had enforced its own rules effectively, certainly on salary spending by clubs and making sure that owners of clubs could demonstrate proof of funds when they took them over, then I believe the situation at Bury would never have happened. It could have been avoided. And the sad thing is that a year on, there is nothing that has happened since then to stop it happening again. And we look at the impact of COVID in particular on Football League clubs. And my fear is that we could be about to see multiple club failures before the end of the year. And really, the Football League is in no position to do anything about it.
Right. That's a fair comment. I mean, certainly my view is that the furlough scheme and the introduction effectively of the pay later schemes in respect of VAT and PAYE, they have deferred a potential problem. But all that's going to happen is that when these rules are redacted, then the football industry doesn't really seem to have made much progress in terms of sorting out its own house over the course of the last year.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's a fair question to pose, well, why haven't there been more club failures already? And I think it's for the reasons you've set out, that they've managed to defer some costs. They've used furlough for staff costs. Fans, as always, have been very loyal in supporting their clubs and have bought season tickets, even though there's no guarantee that when the season will start and whether indeed they'll be allowed to watch the games. So the Football League has allowed clubs to draw down on some of their solidarity payments that come from the Premier League. So effectively, they're drawing down next season's money now, and that's kept them going over the summer. But the crunch is going to come in the autumn when there's no more money like that to draw down. The furlough schemes are being stopped, and clubs are then locked in the position of having to pay players, whether they're playing or not, having to honour those contracts in full. And unless the players will voluntarily give up their salaries, and there's no indication they would do that on a permanent basis. And then they're going to be trapped, because what we really see for clubs in Leagues 1 and Leagues 2 in particular, to a certain extent for a good number of clubs in the Championship, is that they are reliant on matchday revenue. They are reliant on playing games in front of their fans. And if they can't do that, the clubs aren't viable. And many of these clubs have got no reserves to draw on, and the owners may not have the funds to pump into the clubs to keep them going. So I think we are seeing a sort of perfect storm coming. And even with, from what I can tell, the most optimistic assessment might be that by October, we may have a third of fans back in grounds. But if the average of the Football League grounds is about 60% capacity on average for games, that could still mean clubs are playing you know, maybe running at a loss, running match day at a loss, you know, because of the lack of revenue, and it's simply unsustainable.
Well, yeah, unsustainable is the right word. I mean, and I've always felt slightly uncomfortable with the fact that the Premier League, or sorry, the EFL have this reference to profitability and sustainability rules, which, as an outsider, they seem to encourage neither profitability nor sustainability in terms of what clubs are allowed to do. We've seen the introduction of some form of wage cap in Leagues 1 and 2. Do you think that should apply to the Championship as well?
I don't. To be honest with you, I don't think salary cap, an arbitrary salary cap, is necessarily the right way to go. I think the salary protocols that they had in place actually was a perfectly good system, where you, rather than just having a blanket cap that applies to everyone, and clearly if you look at League One, you know, the idea that a club like Sunderland should have the same salary cap as, you know, as AFC Wimbledon, you know, would, I think many people think would be ridiculous. And indeed, if you look at the situation at Bury, would the salary cap stop that? Well, not necessarily, because the salary cap set at an arbitrary level, where for small clubs they would, you know, they could never spend that amount of money, and for very big clubs they're left in a position where they'll only be allowed to spend about 15% of their revenue on players' salaries. So the idea of having a percentage cap, so you can only spend a percentage of your income on player salaries, I think is a good idea, and that's what they have in place. The problem is there's no real time enforcement of it. And the thing that really amazed me when we had the select committee session with the FA and the Football League, was that the FA chairman, Greg Clark, and a former chairman of the Football League as well, would sat there and said, you know, the existence of this scheme, these salary protocols, means that clubs aren't going bust and it's a good system. But there's no real-time data that's part of those figures. They're based on self-declared numbers from the clubs, mainly based on very optimistic assumptions about ground attendance or performance in cup competitions. The club's audited accounts aren't published for some time after the season closes, and then balancing the books is reliant on the owner putting in a soft loan into the club to keep it going. And if you had real-time enforcement of those measures, you could see season by season, week by week, what clubs were spending on players' salaries, then I think you could create sustainability in the way football is run. But I think what that's going to require is, you know, independent directors on boards with access to that data, and some sort of regulatory authority for football, a financial regulatory authority that's got the right to audit and inspect what's going on in clubs in terms of their finances. If we could do that, then I think you could say clubs need to be run in a financially sustainable way. I also think we'd also get rid of this problem we have now, which is that, you know, at any one time, probably about a third to a half of clubs in the Football League are up for sale. I think we'd attract better owners because it would be a more sustainable business proposition, and it'd be better for competition because you wouldn't have the distorted effect of an owner, you know, injecting unsustainable amounts of money into a club in the hope of promotion or on what is basically a big gamble and bet. You'd have people running clubs for the longer term. And, you know, when I visited Gig Lane in autumn last year, just before the general election, I remember visiting a group of fans who came out to meet me and the people that were part of the visit, and the then MP. And we were standing in the rain in the car park at Gig Lane. And this lady said to me, who'd been supporting the club all her life, you know, she said, this town doesn't have much. We had the football club and now they've taken that away from us. And to me, what that really brought home is that the reason it's so important these clubs are run in a sustainable way is ultimately they belong to the community, and they would be nothing without the community. And we owe it to the community to make sure these clubs can survive.
Well, we're fully in support of issues of that nature. I mean, I attended one or two of the meetings at Bury Town Hall that took place amongst fans groups. And what struck me, and I live near the place, but I'm not a Bury fan myself, was it didn't matter what age you were. You know, there were people from all ages, all backgrounds, but they had this common identity, which was Bury Football Club. And it did give them that sense of community. And that has been thrown away. And what we've seen since then, with issues at clubs such as Charlton, there are ongoing issues at Macclesfield and Oldham and others, that we don't seem to be making very much progress. So you brought out a paper, I think it was in May, where you suggested creating a football finance authority, effectively an independent ombudsman, and what was the equivalent of what, Offfoot or something of that nature. What role would such an organisation play, and how can we have that for football when we don't have that for supermarkets, or we don't have that for computer manufacturers.
Well, I mean, what we do have it for, and interestingly, using the term off foot, because what we have for broadcasting is Ofcom. And anyone who has a broadcasting license in the UK, be that the BBC or a community radio station, is ultimately has a broadcasting license issued by Ofcom. And that's, they have the power in legislation created by Parliament to issue those licenses. And what's interesting is that they have the power to remove those licenses. And they can do so not just by deciding not to award a license to someone bidding for one, but they can take a license away from someone who holds one. And in some cases, they have done that, not very often, but they have done it. And they can do it whether someone is in breach of the broadcasting code or whether they feel someone is unlikely to comply with the code based on their past behaviour. Now, if imagine if you had a power like that, an independent body in football like that, that could effectively say to, you know, could stop an owner taking over a club because they don't feel they've, because of their track record or the failure to demonstrate whether they've got the funds to run the club and support the club properly. They could say, well, actually, you know, you cannot take over this club, or a regulatory body that could intervene in a case of a club being clearly mismanaged and there being big problems because of the way the owner is running the club. Now, that would be a big step forward for football. The reason it's not happened is because ultimately football is not run by the FA. It is run by the chairman of the football clubs in the Football League and the Premier League. The Premier League obviously runs itself, and the chairman of the clubs are ultimately the most powerful people in deciding how the Premier League is run. And the Football League is, again, run by the 72 chairmen of the Football League clubs. And they're not that interested in financial oversight, you know, people poking their nose in and seeing what they're doing. They don't want that sort of intervention, and therefore they've never supported it. And they would never allow the executive of the Football League to do it. And they would resist any attempts, you know, probably along with the Premier League, for the FA to take on such a role. But it is necessary, because I think the reason many of these club chairmen don't want this sort of scrutiny is that they're either trying to sell the club and don't want anything that will make it harder to sell, or if they're running things badly, they don't want that sort of oversight. And so it's got to come from a sort of independent body. And when I wrote the article with Charlie Methuen, one of the co-owners of Sunderland, the reason we set out that it should be an independent body was so that it would have that independent oversight. And we also felt that, and I believe this very strongly, is that football will never willingly change because of the vested interest of people in the game for it to be run in the way it is run at the moment. But if football required financial support because of the coronavirus, then if that financial support came, particularly if it came from the government, then there should be strings attached to that. We shouldn't be throwing good money after bad. And the strings attached should be in the form of a proper oversight from an independent body. And there are many people in football who have said to me that in some ways, probably the Football League and the FA would welcome the introduction of such a body, because it would take the responsibility away from them. And the crucial thing this body needs to have is access to real-time information about the way the club is being run. In some ways, if all it did was enforce the existing rules on salary protocols and salary caps, then that would achieve a huge amount. But it needs access to real-time data to do that. So in the same way that in the banking system, the Financial Conduct Authority's got the right to, you know, audit and inspect the way banks are being run, a similar body for football should have similar sorts of powers. And I think that would, you know, wouldn't stop an owner buying a club and injecting cash into it in the hope of improving its position. But it would mean that they would have to demonstrate how they were doing it, make the books available for independent inspection and audit, and allow the football authorities to intervene before the club goes bust. I mean, the common thing you hear, certainly I've heard with people talking to people in Bury about this, was, you know, why is it the intervention only really comes once the club goes into administration? You know, why is there not an earlier intervention before, you know, before they've jumped off the edge of the cliff? Why didn't someone intervene then at that point? And that's what this independent body could do.
So therefore, that would perhaps stop what we've seen at Wigan Athletic, where nobody knows exactly what has happened, but there were warning signs, but nobody seemed to want to act at the time.
Absolutely right. And I think a body like this could be more demanding in understanding the nature of a person buying the entity, buying the club, who they were, what the finances of that organization were. I think a body like this could take a view on what is, I think we've seen effectively, is the asset stripping of clubs, where the ground, the training ground, other facilities are separated from the main football club. And the club itself is just really a big bucket of debt, you know, which ultimately goes into administration, but the owner can somehow step away from it, protect themselves, but still owns all the assets of the club, which it could then sell. It could stop some of those things happening and be more questioning about these sorts of practices. So, and the fans really find is that when there is a crisis at their club, there's no one to turn to. You know, the FA can do nothing. The EFL can do nothing. All effectively the league is interested in when a club goes bust is protecting the competition and stopping a club playing if it doesn't feel that club could complete the season. It's perfectly reasonable position, but it's no use if you're the fan of a club that's gone into difficulties because, you know, of a bad owner running the club in an unsustainable way. And then what you realise at that point is despite all the rhetoric and all the rules and all the things that are there to try and prevent that happening, that they don't work and that the regulatory bodies have got very little power or unwilling or unable to intervene.
Absolutely. I mean, we had Neil Doncaster who's head of the SPFL on the show a few months ago, and he said they do have real-time access to club accounts and to their bank activities. And what they do is that they check that the wages are being paid every month, and they check that HMRC payments are paid when they are due to be paid. And that system seems to work relatively well. It's still light touch, but it's easy to monitor. There doesn't seem to be any desire, and I think you probably hit the nail on the head by saying that the club owners have they don't want anybody's what they see as poking into their business, and they want to run the clubs as private fiefdoms.
That's right, and indeed they do. And there's very little scrutiny of what goes on within those clubs now. And I think looking at the track record of some of these owners and, you know, the concerns you might have, you'd have, I think, genuine concerns about that lack of oversight, concerns about what their real interests are. Do they have the interest of the football club at heart, or have they seen a way in which they could try and make some money for themselves out of assets dripping the club or other things? And so I think that's why we do need this sort of oversight, because ultimately these aren't like any other business. You know, you can't, you know, otherwise you'd see football clubs merging and other things that you said that are commonplace in normal business practices. They're not like any other business. Football grounds are recognized in law as being a community asset. So the council can intervene to stop a ground being sold for redevelopment, and therefore there is a strong community interest that should be represented in some way. And I think we see the owners of clubs are the temporary custodian of a club that is often, you know, more than 100 years old, with great tradition and sense of local pride. They are the temporary custodians, and the job of the football authority should be to make sure that whether the ownership of that club is successful or not, there is still a club to hand on to someone else in the future. And I mean, what I proposed in the ideas I put forward was that, as well as establishing a regulatory authority, if there needs to be a bailout of football clubs by the government, then rather than that just being loans to the club, which I think loans that I believe will probably never be repaid, it should come in the form of an equity stake. And there should be an opportunity for the community to acquire that stake in the club. And I think if we had that, even if these were only stakes of 10 or 20%, it would give the right to appoint independent directors. It would give the right to some sort of oversight of what's going on. So the community could see what was happening within the club. Still an owner, a majority owner, could still run the club in the way they wanted to, but at least there will be that oversight. And I think that would be a welcome step for many clubs, particularly community clubs in Leagues 1 and Leagues 2.
Excellent. Yes, I mean, that's sort of broadly in line with the German model, sort of trying to bring up the preventing one person from wholly dominating a football club and making sure that the voices of fans, who, as you've rightly said, the EFL and the Premier League are both run as owners' organisations, as members' clubs, and it's very noticeable that football fans don't have votes with regards to any of the decisions made. And I don't know whether you've seen the Football Supporters Association, their proposals. Are you broadly in agreement with those?
Absolutely. And indeed, in drafting and publishing my proposals as well, I did that in sort of discussion with the Football Supporters Association as well. And I think their plans are very good. And if you strip everything back from the kind of international global business that football has become, ultimately, football, you know, football is players and people watching people play. And that you find in football that the two bodies that therefore that are fundamental to the existence of football are in some ways the two groups that have the least say on how the game is run. You know, it is the intermediaries, the administrators, who've basically, you know, created the power for themselves. And the interests of players are often, you know, often secondary, and the interest of fans are, you know, again treated as a secondary interest. And fans have, you know, often find when there's a problem that they not only do they have a voice, but they have no influence. And they find that the structures that have been put in place supposedly to run the game have got no power. And I think that is, you know, the wrong way for our national game to be run, and the wrong way, you know, for community clubs to be run. And it creates a system where things like Bury happen when they should be easy to avoid.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Damien, for giving up your time. I really do appreciate this. I'd just like to say to you and all yours, stay safe, and look forward to hopefully making some progress on this in the future. You know, your plans, the FSA plans, are certainly something which we fully endorse as far as this show is concerned.
That's great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Kieran, I found that very interesting. I mean, I have to say, as somebody who's involved in culture and sport, that given the amount of money those two things generate for this country, I think it's shameful that there aren't separate ministers for both of them. And I'm sure people in the digital and media industries would feel the same way. But do you get the feeling, talking to Damien Collins, who obviously personally is a supporter of football, but do you get the feeling that the government perhaps is taking football's issues seriously as well?
Well, he did have some very interesting plans. He was in our camp in terms of his belief that football is part of the local community. It's part of our local identity. And therefore, to an extent, it deserves some form of unique treatment. I think his views that football left to self-regulation will always act in the best interests of owners. Yeah. But as he said, well, if you think about football, who do you associate it with? It's players and fans. You know, those are the two key people involved. And he felt that there should be more done to reflect the interests of both of those parties.
Well, we all think that. And I think everybody listening to this would think the same way. And if everybody listening to this has a question for our next pod, because it's questions time on Monday, it's the usual address, questions@priceoffootball.com. And Kieran, I hand it over to you for our usual last few words. Our usual, okay. I don't know what the usual, there's a difference between the usual last few words, Kieran, and the usual. Do you know what the problem is, Kieran, with this book? Is I've spent the last couple of days recording an audio book for someone, and I'm just expecting to go, sorry, darlings, can we take that again? So, but obviously on this pod, we just roll with the mistakes. So anyway, you do the usual ending. That'd be great.
Well, I'm going to do a slightly unusual ending to begin with, because...
No, don't begin with the ending, Kieran. That's confusing.
can't beat a happy finish, I always say.
You rotter. You've been on such good behaviour all the way through, and you waited till I was off my guard. It's the end of the pod. Kieran's finishing it. I was just doodling a picture of a cat, and then you did that.
So before I do the usual nonsense, I just want to shout out a big happy birthday to Jack the Wickham fan, because this has come from his mate Rory. Apparently it's his birthday this Friday. He's a huge fan of the podcast, and his mate says that he's too tight to buy Jack a birthday present. So would we do a shout out instead? And also, congratulations to Jack. He's just about to take up his first job as a teacher. As somebody that's been teaching myself since the 80s, good luck in that. You know, it is a wonderful career. The money's crap, but the highlights, in theory, more than make up for it. So I wish you all the best in your career as a teacher. In terms of moving on to the usual stuff, thanks very much for all the feedback, folks. You do keep us on our toes, as you probably gathered from the number of stories we're running today. We try to do as much as we can for you. And some of these stories have come from our listeners. You know, the Malaga one was on the basis of one of our regulars getting in contact with us. If you like what we do, if you could give us some feedback using that big purple icon on the Apple podcast app or the Spotify app, we don't understand how it works, but according to producer Guy, it keeps him in beer and Skittles. We don't see any of that, you know, and you can write whatever you want. You know, it's not for Kevin and I's egos. You know, we're used to taking the occasional brickbat. So say eyebrow raising stuff, say not as good as the Swiss ramble. It doesn't make a blind bit of difference to the algorithm that is used by Apple. And apart from that, stay safe and look after yourselves.
Yeah, I'm a very sensitive stand-up comedian, Kieran. So can I point out, I'd rather they said nice things. And also, when we think about it, we've had this discussion before, Ken, how many Skittles does producer Guy need? I mean, we're keeping him in a lot of beer and way too many Skittles. In the meantime, happy birthday, Jack the Wickham fan, and very best wishes on your new job as a teacher, which, as Kieran says, is a very honourable profession. Take care, everybody. The price of football.
Price of football.